This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Monday, the 20th of January, these are our main stories. Reports from the Libya summit in Berlin indicate that several key decisions have been made, including an agreement on how to implement the proposed UN weapons embargo.
If a ceasefire isn't adhered to and agreed and the conflict continues, we really fear that up to 800,000 more people could become displaced and 1.5 million people impacted by the conflict.
We'll get the details from our correspondent in Berlin. The British Prime Minister and the Queen have welcomed the deal reached with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, allowing them to step back from their royal duties. But it was criticized by Meghan's estranged father. Also in this podcast, the space company SpaceX successfully launches its test capsule that would transport astronauts to the International Space Station. And we get the views of an Aboriginal expert on the Australian wildfires. Since the death of its former leader, Muammar Gaddafi, in 2011, Libya has been in an almost perpetual state of conflict. Now an international summit on the country's future is considering how to bring that violence to an end. The meeting in Berlin has brought together many world leaders, as well as the prime minister of the UN-recognized government, Fayez al-Sarraj, and his rival General Khalifa Haftar, who's been trying to take the capital, Tripoli. Misty Buswell is with the aid organization International Rescue Committee. She said agreeing a truce was critical.
We've seen just since April 150,000 people displaced, including 90,000 children. If a ceasefire isn't adhered to and agreed and the conflict continues, we really fear that up to 800,000 more people could become displaced and 1.5 million people impacted by the conflict.
Well, just after the summit news conference, I got the latest from our correspondent, Jenny Hill, in Berlin.
Angela Merkel has appeared at a press conference to say that the leaders of more than 10 countries who've been at this summit today have agreed that foreign powers will no longer send weapons, troops or money to support the warring factions in Libya. Now, on the face of it, that sounds like a huge achievement. Actually, here in Berlin, officials reckon that the fact they've managed to get the key players into the room to talk together is an achievement in itself. What's important to remember about the Libyan conflict is that it's become so much more volatile and complicated than two warring factions wanting to run the country. Both of those factions are supported militarily by a lot of other countries, countries like Russia, Turkey, even Italy and the United Arab Emirates. So this is a step towards those countries saying we're not going to put any more support into this particular conflict. I think rather crucially there are two things outstanding it's worth pointing out. The first is that there's no agreement yet on what happens to the troops, the weapons that are already in the country. That's not covered by today's agreement. Secondly, no truce has been agreed here. It's very important to be clear about that. There is a temporary ceasefire in place, and the people, the delegates, the organisers of the conference today say that they think it was a very important first step to stop more foreign involvement in Libya. That's the first step towards a process by which perhaps a longer-lasting peace agreement can be reached. But today, the first step has simply been to get everyone in the room to agree that they will no longer support the ongoing conflict in Libya by sending in weapons, money and troops. And that is something which Mrs. Merkel said will be put before the UN Security Council, in effect saying this is now the UN weapons embargo. Anyone who breaks it will be subject to potentially sanctions.
And the stakes are very high for Europe too, aren't they?
They are. I mean, quite apart from the humanitarian disaster that is Libya, Europe is starting to be very concerned about the escalation that we've seen in recent months in the country. Europe's concerns are, of course, well, first of all, Libya is a very oil-rich country. They're concerned about oil supply. Even this afternoon, troops loyal to General Khalifa Haftar have cut off an important oil pipeline. They've also, in recent days, blockaded a number of oil export terminals. So that's a concern. But perhaps also for Europe, there are concerns about what happens if more people start to try and flee the fighting from Libya, already considered by many migrants and refugees as a gateway to Europe. And they're also very concerned about the increase in Islamist terrorism across the region.
Jenny Hill in Berlin. On Saturday, news broke that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Harry and Meghan, had reached a deal with Buckingham Palace to step back from their royal duties. The new arrangements will begin in the spring and mean that the couple will no longer use their his and her Royal Highness titles, will not formally represent the Queen, and will aim to repay more than $3 million of taxpayer money used for the refurbishment of their UK home. The Queen has backed their wish for a more independent life and expressed her hopes that they'll find happiness and peace. And earlier today, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson welcomed the plan for the couple's future.
I think the whole country will want to join in wishing them the very best for the future. I said before that I was sure that the royal family has been around a very long time, will find a way forward, and I'm sure it will.
I asked our royal correspondent Johnny Diamond about the wider reaction to the new arrangements.
Well, I think a lot of people are still trying to work out what it means. I mean, at the BBC, we're still getting an awful lot of questions from our audience about what the detail might be. And of course, we're trying to sort out some of that detail ourselves, as is the palace. As we heard in the introduction, Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, has given his verdict. And we've also been hearing from Thomas Markle, that is the Duchess of Sussex's father, estranged father, I should say. There's little love lost between the two, but he spoke after the announcement of a transition period, but before the detail was known, before the detail came out on Saturday, and he gave his verdict on what the two of them, Harry and Meghan, were doing to the royal family.
This is like one of the greatest long living institutions ever. They're destroying it. They're cheapening it. They're making it shabby. They're turning it into a Walmart with a crown on it now. It's something that's ridiculous. They shouldn't be doing this.
The Duchess of Sussex's estranged father speaking there to the television firm Alaska TV. And Johnny, what kind of long-term impact will this have on the royal family and the way they're perceived?
I think it hurts to some degree. It hurts that Harry and Meghan couldn't take the job. It hurts that Meghan clearly felt she was stifled by the institution. It is a tough place. It always has been for outsiders. Even Prince Philip, now 98 years old, the Queen's husband, found it incredibly tough when he joined the palace. I think having come to this arrangement will help rather than have it as a sort of running sore and have them complaining publicly. Over the longer term, it may be something of a blessing because Prince Charles, the heir to the throne, has always indicated he wanted something of a slimmed down monarchy. It was always tricky to work out how that might happen. This is not the way he wanted it to happen, but something of a template has now been created. A model has been created for the way in which those rather less loosely connected to the throne, those not in the direct line of succession, might forge a different life. But this is a difficult time for the royal family, and we're simply going to have to wait to see how it shakes out.
Johnny Diamond. The bodies of the 11 Ukrainians who died when their passenger plane was accidentally shot down by Iran have been repatriated. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was among 1,000 people attending the ceremony at Kyiv's international airport. Our correspondent Jonah Fisher was at the service.
There were 11 Ukrainians, 9 crew and 2 passengers on board the doomed flight. And there were solemn scenes broadcast live on national television as the coffins were one by one draped in a Ukrainian flag and carried from an aircraft to one of 11 waiting hearses. Watching on were Ukraine's president and prime minister, airline representatives and the families of those who died, some of them clutching photos. Though Iran has admitted shooting down the plane, Ukraine is still pushing hard for those responsible to be punished and for compensation to be paid.
Jonah Fisher. China has announced drastic measures to reduce plastic waste as a means of countering the country's enormous pollution problems. Plastic bags will be banned in big cities by the end of the year, and all plastic waste imports are to be outlawed. Our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports from Beijing.
This crackdown on plastic waste was announced in a policy document from the Environment Ministry and the powerful Economic Planning Department, the National Development and Reform Commission. Plastic bags are to be banned in Chinese cities by the end of this year, as will single-use straws in restaurants. There will be some exemptions to the ban, such as markets selling fresh produce. Smaller towns and cities will be given until 2022 to implement the new rules. Plastic utensils as well as tubs for takeaway food will also be phased out. Pollution from plastic is one of China's most serious environmental challenges, whether it be in landfill or waterways. The rapid increase in people's standard of living over several decades has led to an explosion in takeaway food consumption here. However, rubbish management systems and recycling have not been able to keep up.
Stephen McDonnell. The last few weeks have seen several candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination withdraw from the race, but the Asian-American businessman Andrew Yang is still there. He's unlikely to win the Iowa caucus or the New Hampshire primary, but he's already done far better than many expected. His rise partly stems from a policy idea he claims can help fix a broken economy. Our New York correspondent Nick Bryant went to meet him in Manhattan.
A political fundraiser at a Soho penthouse. The contemporary art on the walls, the lights of Lower Manhattan, forming a somewhat jarring backdrop.
I swear, I hope this will be unlike any political fundraiser you've ever attended.
For this is an event for Andrew Yang, a Democratic candidate who's made his name with a policy aimed at America's poor, the economic castaways who feel stranded in a globalized economy.
Thank you all for being here. Thank you for coming.
The 45-year-old businessman has attracted a devoted following, the Yang Gang, they call themselves. And it's his signature policy that stirred so much interest.
How many of you think that universal basic income is inevitable at some point in time?
Universal basic income, a cash payment of $1,000 a month for every American aged 18 years and older, regardless of their income, what he calls a freedom dividend.
The fact is, right now, 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck and they can't get their heads up. And so one car repair, one medical expense, they find themselves in a ditch trying to get out and they can't get ahead. So you give them $1,000 a month, you see, it makes people immediately stronger, healthier, mentally healthier, less stressed out, better able to make decisions that will help move them forward.
Please welcome to The Late Show, Andrew Yang!
Yang makes a virtue of his nerdy, technocratic persona. But appearances alongside late-night talk show hosts such as Stephen Colbert have turned him into one of the coolest candidates in the race. But selling his ideas about universal basic income to most prominent economists has proven harder.
I think there's two issues with it. One is it's really expensive, and the second, is it worth paying for?
The Harvard professor Jason Furman, the former head of the Council of Economic Advisers in the Obama administration.
I think the idea is based on a false premise about the economy. I think for the foreseeable future, work is going to be central to the economy. And what we need to be doing is figuring out how people can do and thrive even better in the workplace rather than giving in to a sort of defeatist form of utopianism.
Most Iowans live paycheck to paycheck.
Over the past 40 years, political polarization has tracked closely with income polarization. We talk of a missing middle in the economy in the same way we talk of a missing middle in politics. Few expect Andrew Yang to win the Democratic presidential nomination, but his ideas are likely to outlive his candidacy.
I'm Andrew Yang, and I approve this message to rewrite the rules of the economy and put humanity first.
Andrew Yang ending that report by Nick Bryant. Still to come in this podcast, the Iranian chess referee who fears returning home after a row over whether she wore a hijab.
My picture was everywhere and they were claiming that I didn't wear a headscarf during the tournament. They called it a protest. So they already condemned me.
At least 75 members of a Brazilian drugs cartel have escaped from a prison in Paraguay. The inmates were members of the drug gang, First Command of the Capital, known as PCC, which is one of Brazil's largest criminal organizations. Our America's editor, Candice Piet, told me more.
Well, the escape is believed to have happened around dawn, and the authorities found a small tunnel starting in the floor of one of the toilets on the ground floor of of the prison, which was housing members of the PCC. They also found 200 bags of sand in one of the cells. But suspicion later has fallen on the fact that the drug traffickers might have escaped with the help of the staff. Now, the Justice Minister, Cecilia Pérez, says she questioned how no one had noticed that the tunnel had been built and so many of these prisoners leaving in such a short period of time. In fact, she thinks that the tunnel could be a red herring and that, in fact, police are investigating whether the cell doors had been left open and that people, the staff, had been helping. Now, the minister has sacked 6 members of the staff of this prison and the prison director.
And what else has happened since the prison break?
People in the local town have now been put on high alert and have been asked to report anything suspicious. On the Brazilian side of the border, security has been reinforced in local cities where they think maybe some of these prisoners might be heading. But so far, no one's been picked up.
And this drug gang, First Command of the Capital, PCC, what's the impact of it on a small country like Paraguay?
Well, the PCC and also the Comando Vermelho, another Brazilian gang, they've become increasingly brazen in this area. They're basically fighting for control from Paraguayan gangs for drug trafficking routes down the Andes to Paraguay into Brazil. Now, the new Paraguayan president, he announced last year plans to amend the constitution to allow the military to operate there because things are getting so bad. Now, the Brazilian gangs are also strengthening control over Paraguayan prisons. 12 out of 18 prisons have around 250 gang members in them, and they use these prisons as a base for their operations, and they want to stay there. It's safe for them and so that they can conduct their work.
Candice Piet. Iran's top female chess arbiter, who's in fact the only woman at that level in Asia, has told the BBC that she's too scared to go back to Tehran after she was accused of violating the country's strict dress code. This all began when a photograph of Shohreh Bayat officiating at the Women's World Chess Championship was published by Iranian media, apparently without a mandatory headscarf. She insists that she was wearing her hijab and was not staging a deliberate protest. Our Moscow correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, has been speaking to Shohreh Bayat, who's currently refereeing the World Championship in the Russian Far East.
This was a really big moment for Shohreh Bayat. She's Iranian and a top-level chess arbiter, one of very few women in the role.
Hello and welcome to the 2020 Women's World Championship match here in Vladivostok.
This is the first time she's ever refereed a world championship. But instead of being excited, she's now scared and angry after a row broke out over her hijab.
2 minutes to start the round.
It started when a photo of Shohreh refereeing a game appeared in Iranian media.
Hello.
Hey, hi.
We spoke by phone across 7 time zones and she explained what had happened.
My picture was everywhere and they were claiming that I didn't wear a headscarf during the tournament. And it was a kind of protest against hijab. They called it a protest. So they already condemned me, but I had my headscarf.
Photographs from other angles that day do back up what she says. The scarf is there, albeit draped very loosely. But on TV and social media back home, she was already being accused of violating her country's strict dress code. Shohreh has always worn a hijab for chess tournaments, though she was never happy about it.
I was tolerating it because I live in Iran. Of course, I think that that is not right. People must have the right to choose the way they want to dress.
Shohreh told me Iran's Chess Federation then instructed her to write something in response to the fuss. She understood that to mean an apology and a defence of the hijab rules. So she refused. And now she thinks it's too risky to return to her family in Tehran.
There are many people who are in prison in Iran because of hijab issue. So it's a very serious issue and I was totally panicked. Maybe they just invalidate my passport or maybe they put me in prison or maybe they want to make an example for me.
It's a question now what White will do. White's got various options. Bishop takes c6 is one of them.
Grandmaster Nigel Short is commentating the tournament out in Vladivostok.
I'm just wondering whether she's going to do that.
He's also vice president of FIDE, the International Chess Federation. The Englishman used to coach Iran's national team, which once included Shohreh, until she switched to become an arbiter.
She is a trailblazer in Iranian sport. I mean, we don't appoint people for World Championship final unless they're very good.
But Iran has been losing a lot of talent lately. Its only female Olympic medal winner just wrote on Instagram that she'd left the country because she felt oppressed by being told what to do and where by the authorities. The male teen chess prodigy Alireza Firouzja has gone too after Iran stopped players attending any tournaments with Israeli participants, and that's most of them. And last month, when Mitra Hijazipur competed here in Moscow without a hijab, she was expelled by Iran's Chess Federation.
We are seeing a dripping away of players. I think it will become a flood before too long.
Nigel Short says FIDE will support Shohreh. Chess doesn't make a lot of noise, but this is the sound of a young Russian challenging the current women's world champion from China. Behind them, I can see Shohreh in a flame-red blouse and her long black hair definitely not covered. She's now taken her hijab off.
I just decided not to wear it. I wanted to be myself.
She's angry it's all Iranian officials have focused on, despite her success in chess. She's not sure of her next move, though she says it can't be back to Iran.
I feel shocked, to be honest, and I feel so sad because I'm going to miss my family. If I have a choice to come back to Iran, of course, I would love to come back to Iran. But I just don't know if I come back to Iran, what will happen to me.
Shohreh Bayat speaking there to our Moscow correspondent, Sarah Rainsford. A BBC investigation has seen documents that show how Africa's richest woman made her fortune through corruption and exploiting her own country. The papers reveal how Isabel dos Santos, the daughter of the former Angolan president Eduardo dos Santos, gained access to lucrative deals involving land, diamonds, oil and telecoms while her father was in power. She has denied any wrongdoing. Richard Bilton reports.
Isabel dos Santos is a billionaire who claims she made her fortune through hard work. But Panorama has seen documents that show much of it came from some very dubious deals. A leak of more than 700,000 documents from her business empire was obtained by the Platform to Protect Whistleblowers in Africa and shared with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Presidential orders from her father allowed her to buy valuable assets for knockdown prices. She and her husband got access to lucrative deals involving land, diamonds and telecoms. Tom Keating is director of the Centre for Financial Crime and Security Studies in London.
That's absolutely the definition of corruption. She was put in a favoured position because she was the daughter of the president.
Angola has vast reserves of oil, and Isabel dos Santos was able to profit. One deal, largely financed by a loan from the state oil company Sonangol, earned her €750 million, or £640 million. Her father later used a presidential decree to make her head of Sonangol. She says the deal made Sonangol money, and her appointment was based on business.
I worked for them as a consultant. That then, after I finished my consultancy work, invited me and said, would I consider the position to become Sonangol's chairperson?
Isabel dos Santos, who faces a criminal investigation in Angola, denies all the BBC's allegations. Her lawyers say she's been involved in no wrongdoing, and it's a politically motivated witch hunt by the Angolan government.
Richard Bilton. Heavy rains in parts of Australia have helped firefighters as they tackle hundreds of bushfires, but the long-term dangers remain, and the federal government has just promised more than $50 million in aid to the tourism industry to try to help it recover. But native residents of the damaged areas say their sense of grief at what's been happening is different, possibly more profound. BME Williamson is an expert in land management at the Australian National University and part of an Aboriginal group of people called the Yuwarlai.
The impact on Aboriginal peoples from the fires is everything that non-Indigenous communities around Australia have experienced and more. to really deeply engage with this question, you need to understand first the relationship that Aboriginal people share with their land is really different to non-Indigenous peoples. You're talking about people with deep and ancient links with the land, including all the animals and plants that live on the land. And with those deep and ancient links, that there's a, I guess, a contract that exists between the people to look after the landscape as well. And so in the aftermath of these fires, where the landscapes have been absolutely all but destroyed, really, in some places, it really deeply impacts people's cultural and spiritual well-being.
What's needed by these communities now?
First of all, support, the basics. So obviously the economies in the areas have been really deeply affected, and Aboriginal people are a part of their communities, and so they're feeling the effects in the same way. But I think as the recovery process kicks up into a higher gear, what's really needed is a deep understanding of the unique grief that Aboriginal peoples experience, and having culturally sensitive and appropriate ways to engage with people and the grief and the trauma that they've experienced from these fires. Without that understanding, I fear that new trauma will be inflicted upon people, because you have agencies and people coming in who aren't aware of their unique circumstances and so aren't culturally responsive, and that's not a good position to be in.
Just tell us a little more, will you, about why that grief is different.
Aboriginal peoples in Australia in particular, but Indigenous peoples all around the world, do live with a sense of perpetual grief, and that perpetual grief comes from centuries of colonisation and the fact that colonisation remains ongoing. So you've got people who have been displaced from their homelands, communities that were really disrupted through colonisation. You've got other effects such as the suppression of culture, suppression of languages, the removal of children. But I think the separation of people from their land remains paramount. And so Aboriginal people, in a way, already live with grief even before these fires have come through. So when you compound it with the trauma of these incredible fires, you get a real heavy traumatic load that needs to be carried by community members.
PME Williamson from the Australian National University talking to Paul Henley. Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, has conducted what's being hailed as a critical test of the abort maneuver it would use if one of its crew-carrying rockets ever developed a problem during flight. Jonathan Amos reports.
SpaceX had promised the escape manoeuvre would be spectacular, and so it proved. As the empty Dragon capsule fired its abort engines mid-flight, the Falcon rocket underneath lost aerodynamic stability, broke apart, and exploded in a huge ball of flame. But by then, the crew capsule was clear and making its way to a gentle splashdown with parachutes in the Atlantic Ocean. This was the last major milestone for California's SpaceX company before NASA agrees to certify its hardware to carry astronauts to the International Space Station. Not since 2011 have American crews launched from American soil. Today's test means that long hiatus is about to come to an end.
Jonathan Amos. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.